The only way you could keep a giant from healing itself was to take its head off in a way that it was so sudden that it could not self-heal. And that's why David cut the head off. And it's the worst death of a royale talked about in the royal cultures. They could not get to their destiny where they wanted to go as disembodied spirits. One sort of thinks that those would be the classification of the terrible ones that are in the sides of the abyss that's talked about in Ezekiel 32. So it's the worst death that they could have. And so when they're going to be beheading people in the end time, that's not for the human aspect. It's for those ones who have that body and spirit that is of the bloodlines that may be they want to be getting rid of, and they don't want them coming back to cause grief. The Golden Age is the time before the flood, the time when angels walked amongst us and they created the giants. The Golden Age is the New Atlantis that Francis Bacon wrote about. The New Age is all talking about the same thing. The Bible is accurate, as always, that they're going to bring about 10 kings. What's the connection there? Atlantis had 10 Nephilim kings created by Poseidon in the mythos and Pluto that ruled over the 10 kings, that was the sponsor of Enochian mysticism, Atlantean mysticism, with all of that technology that was trying to take over the whole world, and that was the Golden Age.
Welcome to the Days of Noah podcast, where we talk all things biblical, supernatural, and strange. On this episode, Luke and I conclude our conversation with Gary Wayne, author of The Genesis 6 Conspiracy, and his latest book, The Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2. Gary talks about Atlantis and the mysticism that they are trying to bring back as the polytheist Luciferian world system, the counterfeit gods, as they bring about the end times. We look at archetypes of the Antichrist through history, Hitler, the Nazis, Aleister Crowley. What were they trying to open up dimensionally as their pursuit of occult practices, trying to perhaps conjure up greater supernatural power on the dark side? We get into quite a bit of eschatology and understanding end times chronology, the royales, bloodlines, and towards the end, Gary gives a great outline of his new book, which I highly recommend you guys check out if you have already, of course, read the first one. And guys, please remember to like this episode, give it a 5-star rating, share it with your family and friends to help grow the channel. So with that, let's conclude our conversation with Gary Wayne.
You're saying that the Nazi Party, as they're, you know, is just another one of these organizations similar to what we were describing. They're rivaling one another. It kind of went rogue, so they got to snuff it out. But then they obviously did some things right. But you think of like Operation Paperclip and some of the activities that the Nazis were involved in. They're like, well, we actually like that part of it, and we're going to consume that and continue to
So two things on that. So the banks are going to fund, for the sponsorship of Nazism, they're going to fund certain families and corporations. And so it's going to become an oligopoly that works with the government, but the government doesn't have total control over the oligopolies, because that's the royals, that's their corporations. Whereas communism had absolute control. There's a bit of importance required for each, But they're working for the same agenda, right? And that's what basically Putin has established in Russia. That's what China has been moving towards. That's our corporate system in the West. And so it doesn't, the ideology is that it doesn't create an inevitable usurping of power and doing things that they that you know get out of control because there's too much power in too few hands. But it's an avenue that they want to have for the infrastructure for the end time. And so when we look at then the technology that comes out of World War II is, again, it's another analogy for the end time. And one of the overarching signs that we get, other than the sorrows, where the contrived catastrophes, man-made catastrophes, get stronger throughout the fig tree generation, which is the other, the second of the three overarching signs. So there's one specific generation where all of those events that Jesus is predicting will be fulfilled. So much so, he underscores it so that people won't reinvent what he says, but of course people do, that heaven and earth will pass away, but his words will never pass away. That is in stone. And the third overarching sign, it will be like the days of Noah. And the technology that merged with the seven sciences that we talked about earlier got so powerful that they were able to do things that we can't do today. And we're just catching up to that technology. Everything from building Machu Picchu or the pyramids, all of these things around the world that are unaccounted for, to understanding the universe and showing that in their imagery, to sacred geometry, to DNA manipulation, genome manipulation, chimera creating creatures, all sorts of things that we just are catching up to because that knowledge of the angels, the angelic technology, merged with the seven sacred sciences to bring about, in conjunction and partnership with the usurping of the kingships of the giants and the mystical religion and Enochian mysticism, caused the flood to be the judgment, both in polytheism, as the polytheist gods bring the flood as well, not just the evil God of the Bible, as they would like most people believe, but in all accounts, it's either the God of the Bible or the fallen angels who bring it about, just depending on which lens that you're looking at it through, to destroy these giants and start anew, even though they show up again after the flood in Bible accounts and all other accounts. So, if it's going to be like the days of Noah, there should be this deliverance of this technology to prepare us for the apocalypse by fire. So roll that back now to World War II as an archetype for the end time, with an Antichrist figure, with a Babel-like religion, with a genocidal or holocaust against the Jewish people, which would have turned into genocide given the time, the promise of the Third Reich, which is a new millennium, right? It's definitely a beast empire wannabe, an end time wannabe, and they get this rapid, unexplained advancement of technology. In 1933, they don't have an army. They are bankrupt. They're not developing any of these technologies. And by 1938 to 39, they have most of this technology that they're trying to produce. They create things like the Panzer and Tiger tanks, revolutionized tank, the tank tactic and warfare, a model that is still used to this day. They created the rocket engine. They created jet engines, single wing aircraft, this bell-shaped thing, which is thought to be interdimensional. And it was all, as you say, all swept up by Operation Paperclip and taken to mostly to the U.S., although the Russians did get some of that as well, but not nearly to the same level. And when asked, where did you get this information? How did you do it? And they would have developed the atomic weapon if the Allies did not take out the heavy water plant in Norway, I know this is being recreated, that the Germans never had the ability to create this technology, and the Americans were the evil ones that brought all of this technology into the world. It was a race. The Germans were ahead of the Allies. And again, if they had been able to produce any of this technology in numbers, they would have easily won the world. Wow. So that's why you have all of these sort of amazing sort of things, I think.
Say that again, Gary, if you don't mind. Where was that that site in Germany? And you said the Allies took it out?
You're talking about heavy water plant manufacturing in Norway.
In Norway. Okay, I'll have to research that one, because I didn't realize that they
were. There's movies about it too, but they're trying to make it go away.
So, I'm jumping the gun, and you're about to hit the punchline here. How did they get this technology?
Yeah. And because it's inexplicable, right? Had they been able to get these things produced in great numbers, they would have easily have taken over the world over time. So they were asked, how did this come about? They said, we didn't create it. We were provided this information through their spiritual guides, celestial white masters, aliens. There's all sorts of different names, but this comes through with the understanding of theosophy, ariosophy, secret societies at depth levels in both, and Rosicrucians at that level. They all communicate with the spiritual world, and that they were communicating as adepts, whether they're secret societies or religious, with these invisible ones who are feeding them the technology.
So very similar to the days of Noah, the Genesis 6 time.
Exactly.
The transfer of information, technology, in exchange for something else. So what do you think that these individuals like the Nazis are giving the, let's say, the angelic or the Lucifer and his minions that are giving the knowledge? What is the Nazis giving in return?
What are they getting? What are the Nazis
giving?
What are they giving?
Because I've heard it. I mean, part of it is worship. I've heard it. It's tied to, I mean, obviously, the days of Noah was, well, there is an exchange between women, or, you know, they were given their women. There was a breeding program, and, you know, in exchange for technology. Was some of that stuff taking place during that time?
Oh, I think so, to a certain degree, in limited amounts. Not like what we'll see in the end time. What they were going to get in return was to be the ones who rule the world, the one who creates that bloodline dynasty, the ones who will permit the invisible ones to walk amongst them again, as they did both before and early days after the flood. So they are what the Nazis are giving the fallen angels is worship, yes. Humans to do what they want with, yes. Major blood sacrifices, right? The destruction of all the Sethites in modern parlance, to wipe out all those who worship God, and to give them complete rule under one government, where they'll have one Antichrist figure who's going to be a Messiah-like figure, and it's going to be a end result as a realm on their own for the fallen ones away from the oversight of God. So if you look at that movie as an analogy, because some of these movies are terrific analogies for what they're trying to do. There's a movie called Doctor Strange, and there's a few of them. But you have this magical alchemy, science, religious type of people fighting interdimensionally against the evil god of the universe, or the evil dark lord of the universe, which is what they call the god of the Bible, to win Earth in a treaty as a realm on their own. so that Satan can be God and they can reestablish that Nephilim world order in a visible way and to walk amongst humans the way it was before the flood and it was taken away from them.
Yeah. So it seems like a increased, you know, as much depravity and unrighteousness and sin and bloodshed and chaos as they're willing to give. And in exchange for this technology and power, what sort of rituals and things? Because I hear a lot about tie-ins to, like, you know, what Crawley was doing and trying to open up these portals, you know, and then we have an increase of UFOs and all sort of things that seems to come out of that decade.
Yeah, there's a technology that can open up portals. It seems, you know, we're starting to see that through science and. Portals are a constitutive part of polytheism, that the gods went back between Earth and their heaven, which is Sheol and Hades. It's in another dimension in the same space as the Earth, where the pit prison is located as well, in a different section of Sheol, but in that same dimension. And the giants at one time could go back and forth between these dimensions. And we get this out of polytheism. And even after the flood, they could do that for a time. And we get that out of the Ugaritic text, which is written in Old Semitic, the same language as Old Hebrew comes from. And you can take the words and make... You can take the old Hebrew back to Semitic, which is great. So you can compare what they're talking about. And these were the RPMs, which is the root word, vowelless Semitic in Hebrew for Raphaim, or Raphaim, as the H was inserted in later Hebrew. Just as you hear the word Napalim with a P, as opposed to the H, same thing happened there. And so these are the Raphaim or the Raphaim or the Raphaim, or as we know them in the Bible. And if you're not familiar with Raphaim, they show up two times as a tribe in Genesis 14 in the War of Giants, and as part of the Mighty 10, or Mighty 7, part of the Mighty 10 in Genesis 15 in the lands promised to Abraham. That's the Hebrew word giant, Rapha, that's used 25 times in the Old Testament versus Nephilim, that's only used 3 times in the original Hebrew. And these are the post-diluvian giants. They're created by Baal and Ashtaroth after the flood, according to the Ugaritic text. And of course, they go to the pit prison for those crimes, and they're trying to bring Baal and Ashtaroth back because they have a fertility issue with giants after the flood. There's something distinct, and probably one of the reasons why they're called differently than Nephilim after the flood. And these are the dynastic royales that serve the council of the Baalim at Mount Saphon, which is Mount Sion in the Bible, or Mount Hermon, or Sirion. It's called many different names in different languages. And there's a tribe of the Datanu, or Datanu, Dedan, as we would get that into Hebrew, Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of Danu, the Scythians, the Indo-Aryans, the giants after the flood that the Raphaim are part of and the head of. And they create these dynastic bloodlines. And they are both healers, rulers, and giants in the Ugaritic text. And all are parts of the Raphaim name. If I have not covered that often in past shows, 7494, healer, 7495, evil spirits, demons, 7497, giant tribe. It's all rooted in 7495 for healer. So if you get a word like Raphael, for example, it can mean healer of God or God heals. And the Raphaim had the ability to heal themselves and others. And they had the ability to go between heaven and earth, both alive and dead, as disembodied spirits. And they would have these funeral parades into the other world. And this is a constitutive understanding that they had that knowledge, whether it was done through technology or words that controlled technology of the angelic technology, they had the ability to do that. So we get that coming through our history, like All Hallows Eve is where all of these demon spirits on their most holiest Sabbath of the year come through portals, domens, on All Hallows Eve and stay here till November 11th as the two-week season goes as Samhain. And at other times they can come through portals as well. I don't know all the rules and why. You have another site at the foot of Mount Hermon that I'm going to talk about, which connects the giants to the gods and to portals and into the other dimensions, that sits below or close to the cave that Baal went back and forth every day between the other world and the earth to inspect his worlds that he controlled, running the Council of the Gods as the head of the pantheon, with, of course, Satan still above that. And that's the gateway to Hades, or the cave to Hades at Mount Hermon, that Jesus went to speak to announce his church. The other place that is located on the Golan Heights is Gilgal Raphaim, Wheel of the Giants, Wheel of the Spirits, and there's 100 domens there.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and that's also the Temple of Pan, right, is right there.
Yes, right beside the gateway to Hades, yes.
Okay.
And many other polytheist temples are there too.
And when you were speaking of the healing part, I couldn't help but think of, in the book of Revelation, of the mortal wound that is healed. So it's a technology or an ability that's supernatural, but it's going to be used as a deceptive tactic by the enemy to almost look like the Messiah, you know?
Yeah, it's to create the pedigree of and the credentials of the dragon Messiah. Yeah, so now if you think about why you have to take a head of a giant.
Mm-hmm.
Just as David killed Goliath with the stone, but he wanted to make sure he stayed dead because he could self-heal. Whether that was a technology, like through sarcophagus, as some people say that there was those technological beds that we're starting to see some of that technology come back that could heal, or was self-healing. But it's certainly part of the giant's meaning, and it's also part of how they understood these royales they could do. And it's also was reflected in a lot of the Fisher King, Priest King mythos, like the Merovingians that were also healers.
Would it also be tied to these societies wanting that technology for their own? Because obviously we're promised as Christians that we're going to live forever. We'll have a glorified body and things. Well, they're doing the counterfeit. They're wanting to live forever, but outside of Christ.
Right.
Yeah. And I'll weave that in here for you. And so the idea that you could, the only way you could keep a giant from healing itself was to take its head off in a way that it was so sudden that it could not self-heal. And that's why David cut the head off. And it's the worst death of a royale talked about in the royal cultures. And it's the worst, as also recorded in the execration text. Like they could not get to their destiny where they wanted to go as disembodied spirits. And then one sort of thinks that those would be the classification of the terrible ones that are in the sides of the abyss that's talked about in Ezekiel 32. So it's the worst death that they could have. And that's why decapitation is part of the whole myth. And you even get this sort of fear happening in the Edomite bloodline of Herod, in the time of Jesus, as Jesus starts his commission in Galilee. And what happened just before Jesus starts his commission and teaching is that John the Baptist was captured. He was beheaded. And when he hears about what's going on in the valley with Jesus, he thinks it's John. And he is mortified because he ensured he took the head. Right. But he thinks it's John. That's their belief system.
Wow.
Right? And so when they're going to be beheading people in the end time, that's not for the human aspect. It's for those ones who have that body and spirit that is of the bloodlines that they want to be getting rid of, and they don't want them coming back to cause grief. So I think that's one of the reasons why you would have a beheading, not for humans, because when we die, our spirits go to sleep and back to heaven. When they die, their soul and body decays like ours does, but their bodies aren't permitted into heaven and aren't permitted to go to sleep. And so they need to have these rituals to find their way into Sheol and not into the pit prison. And that death, seemingly as a terrible one, would take them into the pit prison. So they're either going to be wandering the earth, or in the pit prison, or not in the home with their gods where they would like to be. So the world to come is not for us. The world to come is for them. So you get this understanding that's overlaid on CERN with the destroyer god Shiva. Yeah. We would understand as Azazel, Abaddon, Apollyon, I think. That in that doctrine and the dance of Shiva is that there is a renewal of the earth that comes through the destruction of the earth, and the earth has to be destroyed so that it's probably not inhabitable for humans, but it would be inhabitable to the disembodied spirits who will be rewarded angelic technology, oikotarians of some sort, clone bodies, technology, whatever, that they could live on this earth, but humans could not. And if it was inhabitable by humans and what they would renew from the foundations up, they would only be there for servitude and sacrifice to the gods.
Which ties in the transhuman movement and intersecting of the technology, yes, into our DNA and almost human 2.0. Like, you're the only ones going to be able to survive in this age to come.
Yeah. And that doctrine of destruction and rule of the earth, you also see that in the Phoenix allegory, where the Phoenix rises out of the ashes, and all of that eternity and immortality comes with it.
And I think the mark of the beast, you know, in Revelation, it's saying how men will seek for death and not be able to find it. Yeah. I've always felt like that is a, like Luke said, a human 2.0, a counterfeit eternity where they have a self-healing ability.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe their genetics have been manipulated, so they're not fully human, so they can't be redeemed, and they'll seek death but can't find it because God has basically cut off that pathway for them. They're just going to have to suffer.
Yeah, I think I think what we're going to see is an ability to extend life, and an ability to keep that life going, whether or not that individual wants to die or not. So the pain that comes with it, but ultimately in their belief system, they have to get through that to become immortal in their belief system. So, and the other question gets to be is that apply to humans?
Yeah,
probably it does too. Even though they may, you know. So I think there's a human nature, and then the other question is: does that apply to followers of God? Now it says that that these scorpion creatures that come out of the abyss, that they will not be able to harm those with the seal of God on their forehead, right? Now, we don't get a lot on that in prophecy. We do get the 144,000 that have a seal on their head, but we do get in the New Testament, and I hope this is the case, that, you know, you get the, and it's done an allegory that when you believe in God and Jesus, you become sealed and you have a seal on your forehead. And hopefully the believers aren't punished that way, because it's part of the three woes. And a lot of people will say, well, who cares? They're not going to be here. Well, only if there's a pre-trib rapture, but we're told we're going to go through tribulation.
Someone's going to be here. There's the 144,000 you mentioned that are evangelizing, and there's going to be converts that are going to be living through this and being sealed, as you said, yes, and protected.
Yes, that's my hope and my thought.
Yeah,
because it would be absolutely kind of horrific. And what's really interesting about these scorpion beings is that out of prehistory, we get beings that look like these things. They're called the creatures are created in Sumerian mythology by Tiamat, originally to protect the parent gods from the offspring gods. For obvious reasons in their mythology, as it turns out. And they would protect the gateway to Hades, or Sheol, or Nergal, as Hades is understood in Sumeria, body within the earth in another dimension versus another planet, as Stitchin probably erroneously translated that. I cover that off in book two as well. And I give this comparative description of those creatures in Revelation 9, coming out of the abyss. And these creatures that were created by Tiamat and other gods and other pantheons around the world, and I give several pantheons and versions of it. And they were called the Gerda Balu and the Akraba Malu in Sumerian mythology. That word Akrab is the Hebrew word Akrab for scorpion. Of these things that are coming out. And these seem to be like a degraded watcher.
Wow.
Not a degraded seraphim, which are satyrs, devil goat gods, but something else, as opposed to something that was created that had the ability to destroy the earth. And they're like a warrior type of being as well, and that they were used to guard the sun temples, the palaces. And we know them probably as cherubs and cherubim that had four faces, but these are degraded ones. And when we look at the descriptions of the Akraba Malu and the scorpion beings that come out, it is identical. And I put that side by side in book two.
Wow. Yeah, that'll be
interesting. I wanted to ask really quick, going back to the beheadings, is there some connection to why it is taught by the Muslim religion that they're supposed to behead? You know, Allah teaches that, I think, in the Quran. Is there some connection that you've seen or
were
discussing?
I don't see that. And when I read the Quran, I don't recall seeing a verse where you have to behead anybody for a particular reason. There is hadith influence that probably says that.
Okay.
In the Bible, but from a Muslim perspective, there are two classes of spiritual beings, and they're called jinn in the Quran. J-I-N-N. Or Dijinn is another spelling of it. And one is called, the head of them is called Iblis, which is the equivalent for Satan. So if you remember, I don't know if you saw the original Battlestar Galactica series, there's a series, a few shows on it where they have this godlike figure coming along, and his name is Iblis. That's where they pulled that name from.
Okay.
And he's trying to destroy the survivors of Battlestar Galactica and rule over them. So, and he's a part of the upper jinn, but there's a lower class of jinn as well. So either offspring gods or demigods. It's not clear as I read that in the Quran, but what I do know is the word genie derives from jinn in the Muslim tradition, and that's a demonic spirit. So within that tradition, and having the tradition of the giants within the Middle East, and that it says in the Quran that everything that is written in the Bible is accurate and true, and the account of the giants would be true, and the beheading aspect would be true, and they have that jinn tradition and the genie tradition, one deduces that they will want to make sure that if there's any supernaturally descended beings still having a body that they would want to make sure that they stay dead.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. It just sort of logic dictates the same causes and manifestations and how you deal with that.
Interesting. Yeah. Kind of with the time we have left, I'm looking at a few things. So Darwin, his funding, and Freemasonry.
Yep.
And then I'm also wondering about eugenics, because that was a big thing with Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a possible topic. And then what was the significance of the seat of Satan being moved to Berlin, and where is it now?
Yeah, that's a good question as to where it is now. I mean, it's discovered in the 1850s, and it's the altar of Zeus at Pergamum.
Right.
And again, you get that connection in Revelation to the seat of Satan and the Church of Pergamum. And it is eventually moved to Germany because the Germans discover it, and they put it in a museum. And then the Nazis build a larger place for it. And this is preparation for the seat of Satan to rule for the earth that we were referencing before. So it's all part of their counterfeiting of what they want to do for the biblical side of the prophecy. And they're going to have things, you know, a little bit different because they want to say the Bible is not accurate, right? So, but at the end of the day, I mean, however they get control of this world, the spurious forces don't care, as long as it's at a different timetable and any other detail, and it's not Jesus, and they get that done before Jesus comes back. So,
yeah, for sure. And of course, Hitler wanted that counterfeit thousand-year millennium, right? That he was going to have his Reich last as well.
Yeah, so it's amazing that you would have the seat of Satan with a Fuhrer Antichrist archetype type figure ruling with a beast religion, trying to set up a beast empire. I mean, all of that is not coincidence.
Okay. So I don't know that these are necessarily related other than maybe the same century-ish, right? So what about Darwin, Freemasonry, eugenics, and then Albert Pike and his 3 World War prediction? Because that was all kind of the same time period, I believe.
Yeah, a lot there, all working different agendas in preparation for the end time. So you can't have like a fourth war by Pike's doing, which, so if you have in what they'll say, and they link that up with the Rosicrucian Nostradamus's prophecies, because they do, because they would work together. You know, Napoleon was first Antichrist. Hitler, ancient name for the Danube River, is the second Antichrist figure. And then there's a third Antichrist. And, of course, there's 3 world wars. And they're talking about World War I that they basically caused through their rivalries, World War II. And then there will be a World War III, which is kind of their Armageddon, which Antichrist would come about, and that would be coming through the Middle East as they would understand World War III. So it has to exclude Armageddon, and that World War III will be their Armageddon. That's the counterfeit Armageddon, as the polytheists will try to bring it out. Can we get at that biblically? Yes, we can. So you have, staying with Revelation 9, not coming out of the abyss, but as a consequence of the first woe, you have this 200 million man war with these chimera-like army, as we understand that now. And this is that counterfeit Armageddon. This is not Armageddon, as most, in my opinion, that most Christian theologians say it is. Why do I know that? Because you have a chronology that happens in Revelation, and I won't go through my whole eschatology, but you can overlay it on what Jesus said. And we have other passages that we can link in with this that tells us the timing. But understand that Revelation 7 happens before the midpoint of the last 7 years. right? And we get introduced, starting in Revelation 13, to Antichrist and his rise to power in the first 3.5 years, and then the last 3.5 years is his reign. And the two witnesses are going to be killed by either the Antichrist spirit that comes up out of the abyss, or a fallen angel that calls, that comes up out of the abyss. And that's in Revelation 11. And we start this, the days of the seventh trumpet, when all the mystery of God is going to be fulfilled. Revelation 10 says that. So this happens before that, and happens before Antichrist comes to power, and after the abyss is open. So say 6 months to a year before the midpoint, where this great war is going to take place, that will be the war that Antichrist takes credit for as defeating an Antichrist figure and completing his pedigree, along with his resurrection, healing of the mortal head wound in Revelation 13, as being the one who saves the world and is going to set up his millennium. Now, what other accounts do we have to put the timing here for that World War III? Well, Joel 1 and 2 is that war. Joel 3 is the Armageddon War. Joel 1 and 2, you get descriptions of this army. It is identical to the description in Revelation 9. And in Book 2, I put those two descriptions side by side so people can look at them. This is, and then Armageddon follows later. And the word, if you read Joel 1 and 2 and then Joel 3, you'll understand that 3 is another war. And it is, even though Joel 1 and 2 is a war, it is not yet the day of the Lord. It's like the day of the Lord, but it's not. And this matches up with Ezekiel 38 and 39. This is the Gog War. Gog is a name that does not come out of the Bible. It is a Greek giant. Before the flood, when it was created by Gog was the offspring of Iapetus and Clymene as a human female. And Magog was as well, and Albion was one of his other sons that are listed in Greek mythology. Magog does show up in the book. It's one of the sons of Japheth that intermarries with the Indo-Aryan giants in the Asia Minor area, and probably takes the name, or is assigned the name for marrying amongst the giants. Either way, it's probably the way that that comes about. And Gog is the chief prince of... Gog of Magog is the chief prince of Meshech. Meshech is the etymological root for Moscow. I cover that all off in the book as well. And Gog is a Gyges giant king after the flood as well. And so you have this war that happens before the midpoint of the last 7 years. We get two markers there. You get in Ezekiel 38, it's in the last days. So from a biblical Hebrew understanding, that's the last 7 years that Daniel 9:27 talks about. And Antichrist has not yet come to power. And in Ezekiel 39, after the war, there's second Exodus that happens. That's a last 3.5 year event in the time of Jacob's trouble, in the time of the great tribulation after the abomination. And trouble, and Jacob's trouble, is Hebrew word sarah, which is the cognate word for thlipsis, which is the word used for tribulation in Matthew 24:21. And it's used as affliction in the identical passage for the great affliction, not seen since the beginning of the earth. So this is different than the tribulation of the saints in Revelation 7, but the same as the word affliction or afflicted in Matthew 24:7-8, which also goes back to the Greek word thlipsis. And you can say, well, they use a different word because it's not tribulation. No, that's misdirection. Because if you look at Matthew 24:21, Mark 13:19, the identical account, one uses affliction, one uses tribulation. So it's either in conflict or it's been badly translated. It should have been consistent all the way through. So this war in the Gog War has the timing complete with giants and giant relationships to the Revelation 9 war That happens after the abyss is open. And this is a war that a lot of people think is Ezekiel 38 and 39 is the Armageddon War, because it's kind of like it, but it's not as big as Armageddon will be, but it will seem like that. My understanding will be is Joel 1 and 2, Ezekiel 38 and 39, Revelation 9 is that third world war that Pike talks about.
Okay.
And there was other people in there too that you were talking about.
I'll circle back to those. But a couple things. So how should we understand Matthew 24 and the events? Because I remember a few years ago coming across to somebody on YouTube, a pastor or who knows what, and they kind of broke that down. And I looked at that with fresh eyes and I'm like, oh, wow, I guess I'm a post-tribber now. We're going to go through all that. But then I had somebody explain, no, that's talking about something different. So how should we understand Matthew 24?
So here's the problem with a lot of eschatology. It has a preconceived conclusion, and then they try and make everything fit that. So, and the only way you can make those things fit is you have to reinvent what something says and make people convinced that it doesn't say what it says. And it has to be interpreted is another way of doing it, or reimagined, and that these are topical subjects that are related as opposed to chronological subjects that Jesus provides. Again, one of the ways that they sort of reinvent it so they can make it fit any way they want. And anything that they can't make fit, they just leave out. So they leave out inconvenient passages. You see any of that in an eschatological approach, it's problematic, because everything has to fit perfectly, and you can't be reinventing what the Bible says. And my approach starts with putting everything on what Jesus said, and everything is literal, and anything that we need to understand from a metaphorical perspective is defined within the Bible. And you don't leave out inconvenient passages. And I also like to take it back to Hebrew and Greek to get the fuller understanding. But, and this is where it's important, because you'll get deceived because they twist words. They know that people don't go the extra mile because, and you shouldn't have to, but we're not taught properly in the churches on prehistory and prophecy. So the whole door opens up for this. So we know it's a chronological order that Jesus set down, because he uses the word, and then he says, then this happens, then this happens. And they say, but that doesn't mean that. Well, even in the Greek word, and that word's not inserted like many words are in the Bible, because they're trying to make an old language fit modern grammar and stuff, so you have to insert some words. That's not inserted. That goes back to the Greek word tota, and it means exactly that. It is the when. It is and the chronological order. It is and then it is the then. And you have to understand it the way that it was provided, not the way that you would like it to be provided. And so you get an order of events, and he punctuates that with the abomination in the middle, and then advises us to go back to the book of Daniel for the understanding of that timing. So you get the affliction, the Christian turning against Christian in the first half. You get the persecution. You get the preaching of the gospel in the first half. And then comes the abomination. And then after that, the sign and the rapture.
Okay.
Right? Now, we know we can also fit Revelation on top of Matthew 24. And I like to take the extra details in Mark 13, Luke 17, and 21, and put those additional details onto the Matthew template, because the Matthew template gives the best template. And even in that one, if you go to Mark 13 on the collection of the people from the ends of the earth, it adds the additional detail into heaven at the sign of so. If you start to put those together, and then you go to Revelation, and people say, you can't put Revelation onto Matthew 24. Of course you can. You just have to understand and how it's written, and you have the churches that you have prophecies written within the churches, but also designed for those six or those seven churches. And then you get Revelation 6, which starts in around the last 7 years. And through Revelation 14 to the middle, say about 14:8 or 9, you get the first 3.5 year events. And then you get the summary in exact chronological order, how they'll happen as a summary in the balance of Revelation 14 after the first fruits are in heaven, the 144,000. And then you get those events up to Revelation 19 in detail in exact chronological order of that they'll happen. And then you get the millennium. Now, how do we know we can put that onto what Jesus said in Matthew 24? Well, Revelation tells us this, that in 1:1-3, this is the testimony of Jesus given to the angel to show John in vision.
So to summarize, where do you feel like the best biblically accurate chronology is in Matthew 24 as a part of that 7 years, the tribulation? What part of it do you think he's speaking of? Before, during, after?
Both. You have got the middle.
Okay.
At the abomination, okay, that he guides you to understand the timing of that abomination in Daniel. And that abomination happens when Antichrist rises in Revelation 13 to power and rules for 3.5 years. It's perfect symmetry if you let it fit perfectly.
Yeah.
And all the contradictions will go away if you just put everything around what Jesus said, not vice versa.
Yes. Well, my hope is, as we're building a historical foundation with this episode and the last few, that when we get to more deeper eschatology and how you view prophecy, as you call it, dual prophecy, that's what I'd like to talk about next time, because I think we need to devote a whole couple hours to that, right?
Yeah, well, dual prophecies is, I've never heard anybody define it the way I have, and it's a very special kind of prophecy, and it starts to bring understanding into obscure prophecies, particularly ones in some in the Old Testament. So some of those dual prophecies are like Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, Jeremiah 51, several other ones. And they're unique because they give unique prehistorical information that's important. So like in Isaiah 14, you have the assembly in God, you have the fall of Satan, that's all prehistory stuff. But as in Isaiah 14 or Ezekiel 28, things happen that don't happen in the time of the prophet.
Right. Yeah, it gets confusing that way.
Yeah. But those are prophecies that are filled in the end time. That's sort of the dual nature. And within those types of prophecies, let's say like the king of Babylon or Tyrus, they do things that can't be done or haven't been done. For example, is that the king of Babylon never tried to raise his throne to heaven. He never became an Antichrist type figure. That won't be fulfilled until Daniel 8:10. At the midpoint of the last 7 years, where there's the war in heaven, he actually throws some of the starry hosts down. And that Tyrus did not walk in Eden. So when it's utilizing Babylon, Tyrus, Assyrian, other figures in these dual prophecies, these are the Antichrist wannabes of the time of the prophet, that those prophecies aren't fulfilled will happen with that Antichrist figure in the end time, and that the rest of the details of the prophecies are fulfilled within the time of the prophet. So they are unique, they are special, and the six letters, well, actually all of Revelation is kind of like that, because you only have parts of the prophecies of the letters fulfilled in the time of John. You get all of this prehistory information in terms of the fallen angels, the throne of God, things like that. And you have all of these prophecies that are fulfilled in the end time. So it's almost like that transition sort of type of prophecy. So all of a sudden you take those six letters and you say, okay, he delivered those letters. There's a prophecy for those churches at that period. And then there's prophecies like tribulation of 10 days. That doesn't happen. there are prophecies like, I'm going to save you from the time of temptation or trial, but it's actually the hour of temptation. Hora is the Greek word, and it's the same marker that's used for the hour that the 10 kings give their power over to Antichrist in Revelation 17 to destroy Babylon. It's the same hour that's used in the summary in Revelation 14 for the destruction of Babylon. It's destroyed in that hour. And it's the same hour that is used in the details of the destruction of Babylon in Revelation 18. And this is the hour reserved for when Jesus comes back. Prophecy is perfect in its application if you put everything around what Jesus said.
Yeah, fantastic. And by the time we chat again in the hopefully not too distant future, I'll have finished up Hal Lindsey's The Late Great Planet Earth that you mentioned was so pivotal for you. I just this week started listening to an audio version, and I just wanted to comment real quick. I've never heard anyone put the prophecy about Messiah, the conquering one in Ezekiel and the servant suffering one in Isaiah. I had never heard those two put side by side as a reason of how the Jewish leaders, you know, gravitated to one and in favor of the other.
Yeah. Instead of and ignoring the inconvenient passages.
Yes.
Always a flaw and why they missed their Messiah coming. And so, he was a terrific writer and way ahead of his time. And you know, if you think about a lot of things that he was saying, he was right on a lot of things. And it just scared the crap out of me at that time.
That's right. That's what you said. Yeah. So to speak. The other things I was asking about, I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I wanted to see your thoughts on Crowley and Jack Parsons and, you know, Blavatsky and all that kind of stuff. What were they into? Alice Bailey? What were they trying to open up occult wise and all of that?
They're trying to bring back the basis for the universal religion. They have different names for it. They're in a system in the occult that they do call today the Babel system or the Babylon system, waiting for the Leviathan system or the multi-headed dragon out of Revelation 13 to come in and replace the Babylon beast system with the Antichrist beast system at the midpoint of the last 7 years. And so they're all sort of working to bring that to the subconscious and then to the conscious level in preparation for the deceptions that they want to bring about through the false prophets. And so Crowley is a bloodline. I do have a document a little bit on Crowley and his bloodline back. And it connects back to Irish giants, have the coat of arms. So it's a brief one if people want to know. He's Rosicrucian. So the Golden Dawn Society is a Rosicrucian order. So it's above Freemasonry. It's above Illuminati. It's the intersection as Rosicrucian to the Royal Masonic Orders that are above the Rosicrucians, beginning with the Committee of 300 Families. And the Rosicrucian Society has three different levels. And within its organization with the pure bloodlines populating the top. And they have organizations like the Inkling Society that Lewis and Tolkien were part of. And of course, their bloodlines as well, initiated from childhood, which is why you don't have any Freemasonic. They're higher than an adept Freemason from very early on in childhood, and by the time they're 18, they're well above Illuminati, and so they could be part of that sort of organization. He was channeling a Horus type of Antichrist spirit, or trying to, or at least that's what his thought was, right? And he, it's the Golden Dawn Order. You know, he was thought of as the most evil person on earth at one time, but he was part of a group of writers and organizations that wrote all of this polytheist history. And the you know, the poetic society, mythopoetic society, that's all part of the Inkling group, and it's all part of that writing society at Oxford that is a part of the Rosicrucian society. They're there to prepare people for deception and to lead them away from God. And, you know, Tolkien and Lewis are portrayed as Christians, except that all of their writings is polytheistic, which is why I have a 6-part series on them, 4 on their doctrines and things, and then 1 for each of their bloodlines if people want to get a hold of me on that. So is Crowley an important figure? Probably not. He's kind of famous or infamous, but he's just of a long line of the same kind of belief system, all wanting to bring about the Antichrist. And it's just part of the hierarchical sort of order, just as Pike was. He's, you know, he's not that, you know, powerful or famous. He just, you know, he's kind of famous for putting things in writing in the open. But in the sense of the whole conspiracy over thousands and thousands of years, not very large, but they're all working on an agenda. So everybody in the royal bloodlines, they have a role and a specific role that they participate in. Everybody has to fulfill those roles. So all of these things are just little steps on the way, but it's the larger agenda that we need to understand. So I don't like, you know, I tend not to spend a lot of time on, you know, Pike or Crowley. Yeah, they're kind of interesting, but they're small players in the whole of things. And because they make them so visible, it also kind of helps those who control everything to take our eye on what they're really doing behind the scenes.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and I was just suggesting something to Luke there a moment on text. You know, what do you think of, didn't Crowley have some vision or whatever, and he drew this thing and it looked like an alien gray? And so I've just speculated, because it seems much more UFO activity after the time of Hitler and Crowley was big. Yeah. And I just wondered, did they open up things that now we're dealing with all these, you know, alien, you know,
well,
and interdimensional?
You know, I think we've had these visitations all the way through. I think they're happening more often now. So there could be more portals, more technology. And certainly Crowley was also a proponent of the Thelemic Church or the Thelemic Tree and that ideology. And he took that out of the Greek word thelem that's used in the Bible for God's will. It's also mistranslated a couple of times more as sexual freedom and abominations, poorly translated and again, I cover that off in the new book, but that's part of their ideology of not God of the Bible's will, but their God's will, or their specific patriarchal God that they believe their bloodline goes back to, in terms of that sort of understanding. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different things that sort of intersect in him, and he's kind of, you know, infamous for that. But if you look, and he was involved at the same time as the Nazis were rising, and his influence is connected to that, as with the Rosicrucians and the secret societies, and, you know, that real ideology in Nazism, something in the blood, is a Rosicrucian concept. And it's that real ideology, the something in the blood that goes back to the demigods, that is that part of that whole interconnection that I didn't cover off before. So yeah, there's things that are there, and he was part of the quote unquote Western version of National Socialism, the Progressive Movement, that, you know, had to go completely underground for, you know, over 20 years after World War II for obvious reasons, and now they're the dominant part of the left these days in Canada and the U.S., and that's the type of dystopian world that they want to create, that National Socialism, their Eastern pillar from before World War II on a globalist scale. and they do the same policies as the Nazis did, and they reimagine national socialism as a right wing ideology.
Right.
So they, again, all of that reinventing of things, and they have the ability with their power through education that they control to make absolute falsehoods fact. And they're allowed to have any fact or truth they want as it suits them. But if you disagree with them as a conservative or a Christian, then you're just a liar because you're trying to tell a truth that we say isn't a truth.
Yeah, for sure. I had a note here real quick as before we leave the Crawley topic, something about the golden age birth of black magic and what was he trying to resurrect?
Yeah, so the golden age is the time before the flood.
Right.
The golden age is the time when angels walked amongst us and they created the giants, both before and after the flood. It's Zeptepi. The golden age is the age of Atlantis.
Yes.
The golden age is the new Atlantis that Francis Bacon wrote about, where you have a world empire and you have a religion and science that meshes together. And that whole philosophy is why he's the inspirational founder for the Royal Society that we talked about earlier on. And that new golden age, the new age, is all talking about the same thing and why we should expect the Bible is accurate as always, that they're going to bring about 10 kings. What's the connection there? Atlantis had 10 Nephilim kings created by Poseidon in the mythos and Clytie that ruled over the 10 kings that was the sponsor of Enochian mysticism, Atlantean mysticism, with all of that technology that was trying to take over the whole world, and that was the golden age.
Yeah, and but as reference to the black magic, there's something I may have heard you say. It was the golden age birth of black magic that he was trying to resurrect. Yep. Does that ring a bell? Yeah.
Yeah. So, it is an age of the seven sciences, of sorcery, of technology, angelic technology. And in polytheism, you have white magic and black magic. White magic is used for the good of humankind, so they say. Black magic is used for the destruction of humankind. Black magic, as Atlantis was trying to take over the world through force, through wars, and to exterminate humankind. And that's the Enochian mysticism that was come to full force in the antediluvian beast religion, with the antediluvian beast government system, in the antediluvian beast trade system that the book of Isaiah also talks about, Tyr as being an allegory for an end time empire and also for what I think is an antediluvian empire, Atlantis. And part of it is the beast commercial enterprise of Babylon and Antichrist in the end time, just as it was part of all the beast empires. So controlled the trade. And you have the beast Antichrist that would have been wanting to lead that empire to control the world, but the flood comes along to ensure that the world isn't completely destroyed and humankind isn't wiped out.
Yeah, yeah. Fantastic. Wow, thank you so much, Gary, for your time today. Looking forward to picking up where we're leaving off here and getting into some more eschatological, although we peppered quite a bit of eschatology in here, which was great. But yeah, I think we covered pretty well on Hitler and the infiltration into the seminaries and just some of this converging, as you said, of world powers, the elites, the bloodlines, as even as they're vying for power, they're opening up and preparing a way for this one world government that they want.
Yep.
So fantastic. Well, why don't we let you plug your new book? We're excited to have that come out. By the time this episode posts, it will most likely be available. So yeah, go ahead. Anything you want to share there and how to contact you?
Yeah, so the Genesis 6 Conspiracy Part 2, How Understanding Prehistory and Giants Helps to Define End Time Prophecy, is the new book. And I've been talking in things that I do cover off in the new book. And I also covered off things from the old book, as we were talking about throughout the show. You can read both books independently, but one will lead you to want to learn more about the other one. Book one is more of a globalist understanding of how the world saw prehistory, including the Bible. It's written from a Christian biases, but I let the spurious forces speak for themselves in what they believe, what was, what is, and what will be. And then I match that up against the Bible. Book two is specifically written for Christians, and it goes deeper into the Bible than any other book does. So as unique as book one is, this is equally unique, but specifically targeted for Christians, and is in perfect consistency with what book one says, but in a completely different way. So there is no book like this on the marketplace. It goes deep into the Old Testament. If you thought book one brought the Old Testament to life, this is on a whole new level. If you like some of the things that Dr. Heiser did, this is Heiser on steroids as
for
well.
Sure. Yes.
Awesome. And so I go deep into the giants and define who the Rephaim giants are and the difference in the giants. I talk about the angelic order and provide what I think is one that makes more sense biblically, and provide you the different orders' names and how you can get through the muddying of translations on that to arrive at that. I go through Mount Hermon, the assembly of the gods, the assembly of the Datanu, and the Rephaim giants, how they're interconnected. And I even introduce Mount Hermon and go through that in detail, and the unicorns on Mount Hermon, as the KGV will talk about, which isn't a word that's in there. And then I get into, underneath that order of the Nephilim, I get into all the different giant names that are listed in the Bible as in tribes, and how you can identify them as tribes and take it back to a specific patriarch through certain ways that I show people how we can trace that through history and through the Bible. And one of the major flags is if it's a giant race, it doesn't have a patriarch in the table of nations,
right?
Like Rapha, right? Or Arba of the Anakim. So you start to build on that concept. I talk about who the Shazu are, or the hybrids, the people that aren't included amongst the Anakim but are taller than the Israelites, that are talked about in the evil report, or in the report and the evil report in Numbers 13. And also that the details are reconfirmed of what's accurate in Deuteronomy 1, 40 years later, by Moses. And so we know that that's true. So I talk about who they are, and they're about 7 to 9 feet tall versus the size of the giants as hybrids. Take them back to a specific patriarch and show you how we can do that, and give you a classic example of Timnah and Eliphaz as creating the hybrid Amalekites versus the Amalekim that predate them in Genesis 14. And get into like the 9 quote unquote patriarchless tribes of Canaan, why they're not listed. You get Canaan, Heth, and Sidon. Then you get Amorites. You get Jebusites. Why aren't they listed? Because they have a Rephaim patriarch. Identify that. Then I go through all of the giant wars from Genesis 14. These are post-Diluvian wars. And then the wars of the Exodus, and show you how you know they're warring against the giants and the hybrids of the stuff that, with the information I provide before that. And then I take that right through how we identify those giant wars in the age of the judges, and through the wars of King David, the wars of King Saul, and through Solomon. And then all that interesting information on the important words that we need to understand the context of prophecy, I start to utilize in laying down end time chronology and showing how everything fits. And I produce my approach in the preface so that people understand how I get there in terms of my approach and the disciplines that I use, and take that right through to a template. I can't show all prophecy, but I give you enough of an example that lays down a nice little chronology for you. And I also cover off in those later sections as I'm transitioning into the end time. I know this is a long summary on it.
No, it's great.
But just I also cover off not only the dual prophecies in detail and show the examples and how to apply them and why I define them as dual prophecies, but I also cover off the Jesuits and the Thelemic tree that I refer to that I didn't cover in book one.
Yes,
fantastic. Wow, Gary, that was incredible. You take my money. I want the second book.
Here
ready.
You go. Here you go. Well, I like what Michael, I think it was Michael Basham. We had me and Rod Smith from Millennial Mustard Seed and Rick from That's So Fringy, and Luke and I did a show together, and I think it was Michael. He goes, let's have a contest. See how many times, see who can get Gary Wayne on the show the most times.
Well, I just did a show with Rod, and I booked him for a show in June.
All right. Well, that's awesome. Well, and you know what I love about, and this is where our show really grew out for me as the foundation, is understanding Genesis 6 and these giant wars, because there's so much ammunition that the antagonists of Christianity love to throw at us and say what an awful God we have. And so the work that you've done, that Ryan Peterson did in his Judgment of the Nephilim, that type of stuff, Heiser's work, is so crucial for apologetics, to be able to have good answers.
It is. For why and these, be able to go to a place and get that information. You know, I go on a lot of shows that aren't Christian, and they say, well, why was the God of the Bible so evil that he would wipe everybody out from the face of the earth with a flood? I said, there's lots of reasons for that. I won't go through all the reasons here now, but what I also fire back at them, I said, you know, in all the polytheist versions, it's the gods that you worship that brought about the flood. Now, that's a counterfeit, but...
I got a quick question, Gary. Have you done anything similar to what Mike Heiser has done as far as going to any of these UFO conferences, or you just mentioned you've been on some non-Christian shows, and you're coming at it from... You got common ground with them, but then you got the Christian foundation.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if some of that stuff has been beneficial.
I've not been part of any alien conferences. They like some of the research that I do, but I would not be permitted to connect it back to the Bible in a way that didn't reinvent what the Bible said.
Okay.
There is one group that I'm working with that, I hope to be at that convention in October. They had to cancel me out of one 2 years ago, right at the last minute, and then tried to reinvite me. And then I filled in my schedule and I couldn't go there. It's a unique group that involves all walks of sort of research, whether it's alien, polytheist on giants, and a lot of fairly well-known people. And they want somebody who, at least they say they do, from what the organizer tells me about what he knows about my research, they want that strong Christian influence. They want that strong Christian conservative influence and the literal influence to add into the hidden history that they're trying to build, as to create sort of a common ground of agreement of what happened. And they feel that they're lacking this other side because it's all driven by other belief systems, and they need somebody strong enough to be able to present that. So, and they want me to sit on the board, but I want to see, I want to see the group first. And it's a long ways over. It's expensive. It's all the way over to London where they usually hold the conference. So we'll see whether they go through with it.
But we really appreciate all your academic research, and the way you can articulate it is just amazing. And I'm sure it translates in the second book. As you just expounded in the last few minutes.
Thank you for your time today. Yeah. And one other thing for people is, because, you know, book one, I have like over 100 pages of endnotes, right? So everybody can sort of, they want to go back, and check the veracity of the and the source, then they can do that. But that gets to be a little bit of a pain in the butt, and you get tired of doing it because, oh, he's got a reference for everything. I'm not going to check everything out. I do footnotes this time, so it's on the same page.
Okay.
Because I want Christians to be able to look at what's being said, look at the passage, and look at the other information I may have in those footnotes. So that's right there. So again, this is written for Christians to answer the questions that they don't talk about in churches, prehistory, prophecy, how they connect, and to help you take ready-made research and arguments to dismantle the naysayers.
and as we've stated for the last couple hours, it is so needed because the enemy is embedded himself in the seminaries, and this stuff is not being taught. And your voice is a bright light on this subject that all Christians and all pulpits should be talking about.
Yeah. That's right. You know, I work alone. I'm a one man show. When I came on to the scene in 2016, starting to do social media and then doing some interviews, I was surprised at the conversation in this genre. And I hope that I've been able to change the conversation in a way that it wasn't before, and open up the avenues and understanding for Christians. And the feedback I got is that book two, probably, you know, would have been nice to have done that first. I don't think people would have gotten to this level without the preparation in terms of connecting more dots. So I think book one has made the way for book two. And if I would have listened a little bit better, I would have written it sooner. And that the book I was trying to write and I couldn't get done, I'm writing now because book two showed me how to write book three.
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah, for sure. So everybody, you know, read Unseen Realm. And then read Gary Wayne's Genesis 6 Conspiracy 1 and 2.
And, yeah, for and example,
if your head doesn't explode.
And I've not read Dr. Heiser's work, but I hear such good things about it. And what I heard that he wrote about Armageddon and the IN and the repronunciation as Megiddo or Moad, I do that and more. Just on that one subject, and I give all the other passages that support it, the understanding, and understood as directed in Revelation to understand it as it was originally written in Hebrew to Mount Hermon and the base of Mount Hermon. You know, as Dr. Heiser, I heard, said there's no mountain at Megiddo. He's right. There's a city of Megiddo below Mount Hermon. You can use that part of the understanding, but that is the mountain of the assembly. And when you understand all of the meanings of Moad, it just makes perfect sense. And I lay that out for part of that understanding. Yeah, that's just one example. Was when I say it's when I say it's Heiser on steroids, I give you so much more about Mount Hermon and Megiddo. Yeah. Hopefully, it'll help make sense of things for Christians.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, like I said, that's where our show lives. I think it's just so important to have good answers. And when we have you back, let's talk about those points that you just briefly mentioned about, you know, when someone brings up this genocidal God. I would love to hear your thoughts on that. Thanks again so much, Gary. Appreciate your time, and look forward to having you back.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. God bless.